Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, changemakers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by the Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, proud B Corp, using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. VSAC helps students of all ages save, plan, and pay for college and career training with education and career planning services, need-based grants, scholarships, low-cost education loans, and Vermont's official 529 college savings plan. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. Norwich Solar Technologies, providing complete clean energy services to Vermont schools, towns, nonprofits, and businesses. Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as the Green Mountain Club. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable childcare in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. And nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org. Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. China has been in the headlines, ranging from protests in Hong Kong to human rights abuses to Donald Trump's trade war. To learn more about China, we're joined by James Millward, a China expert and history professor at Georgetown University. Millward's op-ed pieces about China can be seen regularly in the New York Times, Washington Post, and other publications. I began by asking Millward why China had become an obsession of American conservatives.
I'm not sure it is a fixation of all conservative politicians or conservative forces in the U.S. It has been brought up by Senators Rubio and Cruz in particular, and Vice President Pence and actually Pompeo have also sort of weighed in on some of these issues. I should back up a little bit. There's two approaches, there's two kind of areas of attack that conservatives see about China. One is religious freedom, and so the folks I just mentioned there are concerned about those issues. And then the other is this: China is going to eat our lunch. China is out to get us. And that I would associate with the kind of hawkish wing, John Bolton, who recently left the White House, very, very hawkish about China. And the reason I distinguish between those two is that the first group who are concerned about religious freedom are coming very much from the evangelical wing. They're associated with Christianity, particularly evangelical Christianity, or perhaps with the old kind of Cuba lobby. Marco Rubio and Cruz are, of course, Cuban Americans themselves. That, they're more old school anti-communist and very concerned about religious freedom. The Bolton wing and the strong anti-China hawks in and around the Trump administration and some of them now out of the Trump administration, they're more closely associated perhaps with the neoconservative kind of approach. And they don't really care about human rights, but they're quite militaristic in their approach to China. So there's overlaps between that, overlaps in those groups, but they're actually coming from very different places. And so how they react to China is going to differ because of that.
What has been the impact of the trade war on China?
So this is a question that's currently, that's always being debated. Obviously, the rationale behind the trade war, insofar as there was a real rationale, and it wasn't simply an example of Trump chaos, the rationale was this would apply real pressure to China, and the Chinese leaders would have to do something that U.S. leaders want, either buy more American goods, which is how Trump framed it, or how most economists and others look at it, China would make structural changes in how they deal with foreign corporations and how they deal with their currency, how they deal with intellectual property rights and that kind of thing, that are necessary changes. So this was the goal of the trade war. And the question is whether it's really hurting and whether it's really affecting China and whether it will actually, it could, the tariffs could actually achieve those goals. The Chinese economy is slowing, but it has been slowing for some time for big structural issues, big structural reasons. In particular, China is moving out of its older pattern of export-led growth, of being a manufacturing center for the world, the world's factory, and is what China is making is moving up the value chain. And so there's some transition from making textiles to making higher-end sorts of objects like electric cars, for example, that kind of thing. So there's that transition. And also, Chinese leaders have been trying to shift China to a model, again, not based on export-led, not based on exports, but based on more domestic consumption. So the slowing of the Chinese economy has been going on for some time. There does seem to be some effects of the tariffs in certain sectors. It's not bringing China to its knees by any means, and certainly as we've seen from the way the trade talks have gone between U.S. and China so far, they're certainly not in any particular hurry to reach any kind of big deal. So it's having some effects, but it isn't bringing us closer to the goals that either Trump or more broadly sort of China hawks have hoped.
One thing I wonder is in my travels in the world, is if there is an opportunity here for China in the Trump era as the U.S. recedes from the global change, the global scene, China is seeing new opportunities. Is that a fair assessment?
So China has been pushing to have a broader role, a bigger role, more prominent position in the world, again, for some time. This predates Trump. We see it in various ways. In particular, China has launched this initiative, which is called the Belt and Road, or One Belt and One Road initiative. And it's not really one project. It's sort of a brand name for a whole bunch of Chinese investments around the world, in particular in Central Asia and in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia. And it's a way that they're kind of trying to sell investments in transport infrastructure, investments in energy production, a lot of it driven by loans, some of it by foreign direct investment. And so that is a, if you pull together kind of all of the money that China, both at a state level and through all of its various sort of public-private businesses, is investing in these kind of things, that's really huge. And it is having an impact, and it has made China, it has given China the ability to enforce respect, right, from countries around the world, and in particular in those regions I just mentioned. There's another way, so it's very ironic, right, because at this moment where U.S. has been pulling back, or at least the administration, the Trump administration, has been talking about making America great again by having less of a position in the world and being less prominent in the world, at that very moment, China is reaching out. And there was a few years ago at the Davos conference, in Europe, in Switzerland, this big kind of confab of globalists. It's often kind of a joke that people talk about it. But important people get there and talk about sort of big ideas. And a couple of years ago, a few years ago, Xi Jinping, China's president, gave a keynote speech there, and everyone marveled at the time because he was speaking in the language of neoliberal globalism, right? Talking about, trade and openness is good for everybody, and the rising tide will float all boats. And he sounded sort of like a Clinton-era American booster, right? But he was taking that position. And, of course, the U.S. is no longer talking in that way. And of course, we've gone back to, under Trump, we've gone to, using tariffs and protectionism. Now, the irony is, and it's a huge missed opportunity for China, is that at this moment when they really could step up and maybe fill in some of the gap left by the United States, and seem to be about to do that, they've had these huge human rights crises, which have become international, have brought in international condemnation, one being the repression of Uyghurs in Xinjiang and the concentration camps and the surveillance state that they've built there, and the other more recently being Hong Kong, where, of course, protests broke out over a proposed extradition bill, but then the protesters' demands have expanded to include demands for more autonomy. And the violence of the police approach to that, clearly being directed and overseen from Beijing, has also brought in international opprobrium. So there really was a moment where China could have been the adult in the room, as U.S. kind of backed out under Trump. And I think they really missed that opportunity.
So let's turn to some of these issues of human rights, and particularly Hong Kong, which I think for Americans, these scenes of incredible turmoil in the streets of Hong Kong are, many people are a bit confused about what does this come from and what is this about? And I should also mention to those who are just tuning in, you're listening to the Vermont Conversation, and we're talking to James Millward. He is a China scholar and a professor of history at Georgetown University. So back to Hong Kong, explain what is happening there.
So Hong Kong, of course, it was a British colony, which was taken from the Qing Empire in the early 19th century. And in 1997, it was turned back over, both the island of Hong Kong and the nearby territories known as the New Territories, was turned back over to China under a deal which allowed Hong Kong to remain sort of quasi-autonomous from China for 50 years. And this is called One Country, Two Systems. And this was China in the Deng Xiaoping era saying, yes, we are a communist country, but we can accept a capitalist economy, under our rubric, under our umbrella like that. And since then, whether we're talking about capitalism or communism, in economic terms, doesn't really matter so much for China or Hong Kong. It's all pretty capitalistic. But the question of rule of law, of how the government is run, and so on, Hong Kong has still had a measure of autonomy there. At that time of the turnover, in what became Hong Kong's little constitution called the Basic Law, there was a promise that more democracy would be given to Hong Kong. And that would be how this autonomy would be realized. The British had given Hong Kong rule of law and institutionalized free press and pretty much the whole democratic package, but they never allowed them free open elections for their own leaders. And that was, I think, a big failing, of course, of the British. In theory, Hong Kong was supposed to get that in this 50-year period, but PRC, the Communist Party government in Beijing, has not allowed it. And they promised something like that in 2007, didn't deliver. Again, in 2014, there was supposed to be more democracy given. And what instead they gave was this system whereby people could vote for their chief executive in Hong Kong, but only from a slate of delegates chosen by Beijing. So it's not real democracy. They can only pick among people already picked by Beijing. So there were demonstrations in 2014 against that. That was the umbrella movement, which some people may remember. Very young, led by teenagers and students, all very brave, going out there. And they used umbrellas to block the tear gas, which is tear gas and pepper spray, which is being sprayed at them by the police. And they occupied a central part of Hong Kong for some time. And eventually, they couldn't camp out there forever. And so they had to back off, and people went home and, in a sense, agreed to disagree. Now, back last spring, an extradition bill was introduced in the legislative council in Hong Kong, which would have allowed extradition of people accused of crimes in Hong Kong back to China, where they would disappear into the very non-transparent Chinese legal system. And that was very, very strongly opposed by pro-autonomy people in Hong Kong and by these sort of younger people, but significantly also by the business community, because the last thing that business community wanted in Hong Kong was to be liable to be sent back to China and tried there, right? Particularly with all of the anti-corruption drives and so on that Chinese President Xi Jinping has been having. And that was actually, I think, a critical error on the part of PRC, allowing this extradition bill to sort of go forward, because they lost the support of the business community. And it had always been the business community that was really the rock, the sort of pillar of support for Hong Kong remaining close to the PRC. So that's why the demonstrations began. And then they were so brutally repressed. I mean, many of them were huge marches. People may have seen these over the summer. 2 million people in the streets out of a population of 7 million, right? And many, many marches every weekend of, maybe not up to a million, but hundreds of thousands of people. And then around the fringes of those marches, there have been more and more violence. This is, of course, the question: is it instigated by rioters, as PRC calls the Hong Kong people? Is it instigated by the police, who are responding with too much violence? There's a lot of fog of war about this. Certainly, some of the protesters, again, at the fringes, have been using more aggressive tactics, and often recent demonstrations, sort of end up later in the day, later in the evening, with police and protesters battling it out. But by far the bulk of this has been, marches, peaceful marches by everyday people, people carrying babies, old people, and so on and so forth, who all strongly believe that the autonomy which is promised to Hong Kong in their basic law, should be observed, and they feel it slipping away.
Well, so recently we saw the National Basketball Association come in for serious trouble with the Chinese authorities when the general manager of the Houston Rockets, in advance of some big marquee NBA teams playing in China, tweeted, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." Why did China react so strongly? Canceling some NBA games. This is a huge business and cultural opportunity there. What are they so sensitive about?
So you just, in asking the question, you said, why did China react? And I want to distinguish between China and the Chinese people and the Chinese Communist Party, right, in multiple ways. Twitter is not available in China, right? So when people say, oh, your tweet has insulted 1.4 billion Chinese people, that's garbage, right? What happens is that the nationalistic Chinese outside of China, of course, can see this, and they will react as well. But if something becomes a big deal in China, it is because the Chinese authorities have decided that it should be, right? So they allow information about this tweet to circulate on Chinese social media. They publish it in state media and so on. So we have to understand this is curated outrage. It may not be totally created false outrage, but it's curated, controlled outrage. This is just the latest example. We've seen several of these before. None quite as big as the NBA example, but for example, an employee at Marriott Hotel based in the U.S., I think he retweeted or liked a tweet by the Dalai Lama, which was just saying something about being compassionate. And the very fact that he'd liked this tweet by the Dalai Lama, and he was a Marriott employee, brought down this outrage again on the Marriott Corporation, who then fired this employee and issued an abject apology. We've seen it with airlines who have put their flights to Taiwan and their flights to the People's Republic of China, you know, sort of in different places or call them different things on their websites. And China says, no, no, Taiwan's part of China. You can't do that anymore. So they've all been forced to change this. There have been several examples. Fashion companies and others have been, you know, victimized by this. And the problem is, you know, China's a big market. And so no company and no board of directors wants to see a big boycott of their product in China. But China is clearly using this ability to, to say, oh, the feelings of the Chinese people are being insulted, using this ability to intimidate corporations as a way of projecting its own narrative, right? It's as a way of censoring how we look at China, what we say about China, what we say about what's going on in Hong Kong, what we say about what's going on in Xinjiang, and not just forcing apologies, because we've seen examples of how foreign companies, Hollywood in particular, proactively then go out and, for example, use maps which China has put out that show that China that show most of the ocean in off of the coast of Southeast Asia as Chinese territory. This is not recognized internationally. In fact, China lost a world court case about this. But in the Disney movie Abominable, there's a map on the wall that shows the so-called nine-dash line, which is kind of like Trump's Sharpie line with the hurricane in Florida. It's a line that's drawn down like a big polyp into the South China Sea, and China says that that's all its territory. That's where it's been building, islands and so on. So here we have a Hollywood movie proactively promoting a inaccurate and highly contested Chinese territorial claim, right? So what happens is corporations go beyond even being careful to actually, do this. And China's, playing this very, very, very well. Now, the danger is, in the case of the NBA, right, this was one manager of one team, and yet the whole league got pulled into it. Recently, we saw LeBron James was asked about it, and he gave a very disappointing answer in that he said, oh, I think that Morley, hadn't studied, didn't know what he was talking about, right? So that's clearly not the case. We all know, we can all read the papers, we can all see what's going on in Hong Kong. The problem is now, basically, all corporations are going to be held hostage to this. Anything which any employee says, not even, on an official website or an official Twitter account, but, if China can figure out that some employee, some team member says something that they don't like, then they can bring this ton of bricks down on the corporation itself. It's going to make it very, very hard to do business in China. Than with China. And ultimately, I think that people outside of China are going to say, wait a minute, right? And there's going to be backlash against the corporations for so abjectly agreeing to, so abjectly apologizing when these things happen, and then also, actively promoting a Chinese version of things, which is clearly wrong. So I think what needs to be done about this, corporations need to draw the line, as the NBA head, Adam Silver, he seemed to be doing that in one of his statements where he said, I'm not in the business of policing the speech of, all of our employees. And the thing is, this is really a case of bullying, so that if people get together, if they agree, if companies can agree not to be bullied by this, then they won't be bullied. But if you're picked off one by one, then, there's no hope.
We're talking to China scholar and professor of history at Georgetown University, Jim Millward, here on the Vermont Conversation. Jim, we've been hearing a lot about vast concentration camps in the western part of China, in which the Uyghur minority has been imprisoned. Can you explain who the Uyghurs are and why this is happening?
So it's Uyghurs and also Kazakhs and some Kyrgyz. There are Turkic language speaking Muslim groups in the far west of what is China today. They're called minorities officially, but actually they're, you know, we could also call them indigenous people because they're, you know, from that area, which was conquered in the 18th century, sort of brought into the Chinese empire in the 18th century. And, you know, so because of that past and because of how they've been treated by Chinese policies since, there's a good deal of dissent. There's some people who have in the past, and I suppose still now, although it's hard to know, you know, would like that area to be independent. There's zero or, you know, vanishingly small chance that it could be. There is no organized resistance movement or anything going on in the territory. There's, you know, isolated events here and there. There's sort of low-level chronic unrest and stuff like that. But there's no, you know, liberation army or anything like that. Nonetheless, China reacts very, very, you know, with great concern about these expressions of dissent. And in recent years, they've become more and more, they've shifted more and more to seeing religion itself, the Islamic religion, as a source of these problems. And in a way that's really pretty new for the PRC, they're moving towards sort of cultural assimilation as an approach to this. Maybe out of desperation, because, you know, after, you know, decades of raising standards of living and you know, economic integration of the region with the rest of China, you know, sort of the independent thinking and the cultural difference of the people hasn't gone away, and so China's leaders are frustrated. So now they're actually trying to make it go away, and so we see these assimilative policies, of which the concentration camps are part, but they've also been arresting and disappearing the cultural elites of the Uyghurs, and that's very dangerous. And there's hundreds of thousands of people in prisons, not just in these camps, but in prisons now, who many of whom represent the intellectual and business and political elite of the Uyghurs.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Jim Millward, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks. It's been great to be here.
Jim Millward is a China scholar and a professor of history at Georgetown University.
We're going to take a short break for the news, and when we come back, we're going to talk with author Arlie Hochschild about her research in Louisiana in the heart of Trump country. Stay tuned.